On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about how SpaceX is already launching their satellites for their new internet service. Plus, the FBI is saying cybercrime losses are on a rise. And Brian Curtis and I talk with a great guest, Greg Young from Trend Micro, about cybersecurity trends and what your organization needs to do to be ready. Twine on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 341, recorded May 10th, 2019. The Wild Wild West of Internet Security. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Grammarly. Grammarly is a communication tool that helps people improve their writing to be mistake-free, clear, and effective. Start writing confidently by going to grammarly.com/enterprise and get 20% off a Grammarly premium account today. And by Atlassian. Atlassian software powers the full spectrum of collaboration between IT teams and the rest of your organization. Visit Atlassian.com/IT to see what IT can be by giving their products a try for free. And by Smart Deploy. Smart Deploy allows IT departments to reimage unlimited computer models from one golden image. Search their library for your models and get 15 free licenses with 1 year of support. That's $720 worth of free IT software at smartdeploy.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twiat, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need some help from some of the top enterprise tech professionals in the industry, starting with our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, great to have you back.
Thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to this guest. And you know what? I'm really looking forward to the Twiat Afternoon Specials, which I'm hoping is going to be next week.
I'm looking forward to those as well. Now, Jibber, you've been doing lots of little side projects. What's your current project that you're working on?
Actually, one of my projects is we're building some occupancy sensors. I kind of talked a little bit about that. But we're also getting ready to go and start deploying some new smart meters. The whole idea is we need to know where, you know, if you put your sustainables in a campus in the wrong place, that means it's going to backfeed to the other buildings over, in our case, some fairly old feeder cables between the buildings, our backbone. So the idea is if we plug the sustainables in places where we use the vast majority of the power, then it gets absorbed into the building and we don't need to feed as much over the old wire. And that way we can shift our capital improvement expenses on when we go and start digging up the streets to go and put bigger feeder cables in.
Fantastic. Sounds very cool. Very cool. Well, folks, we have another great expert to bring in and drop some knowledge on the Twiat Riot. And that's our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, thank you for coming back.
It's always a pleasure to be here on a Friday afternoon. It's a lovely day here in the swamp, and I haven't been doing anything nearly as interesting as Chibert this week. I've actually been off. So this is the first really big geeky thing I've done all week, and kind of feels good to be back.
It does. Now, you're heading to Interop pretty soon here. You're all ready to go, and are you making sure that you have all your time slots booked?
Yeah, my dance card is starting to fill up. I'll be back. I'll be in the office all next week, but then the following week I'm out in the desert. And any of the Twiat Riot who's going to be out there, please look me up. I'll be running around the conference. I'll also be hanging out in the demo lab. So look me up. Let's talk some geeky stuff and enjoy learning about networking, security, and all the other great information that's going to be there at Interop 2019.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we have a pretty great show today. We're going to talk a little about satellite internet and soon how soon will we actually see this high-speed internet come to fruition. Plus, we have a really great guest, Greg Young, VP of Cybersecurity at Trend Micro. He's going to talk a little about cybersecurity and what organizations should be doing to battle those threats. But before we do, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Well, organizations and governments alike, they hire cyber experts to ensure they can stay on top of the defense and ensure that they potentially even have some development of cyber weapons to stay on top of the offense as well. What if those cyber weapons get out and are used by others? Well, what if other governments actually get a hold of them? Well, in recent evidence, it's calling out the NSA's use of cyber weapons in the global arena and how countries like China are actually acquiring these tools and using them from their own machines. Now, that's right. They didn't actually steal any code here, but they siphoned it off the machine during the attack. Now, the IMF would be appalled that there's no self-destruction in 5 seconds here, but some of those same NSA hacking tools acquired by the Chinese were later dumped on the internet by still an unidentified group that now calls itself Shadow Brokers, and which actually were used by Russian hackers and North Korea and other devastating global attacks. Now, the interesting thing here is that there appears to be no connection between China's acquisition of the American cyber weapons and the Shadow Brokers' later revelations. Now, in addition to these discoveries, Symantec discovered this past week that the Chinese state-sponsored attacks or hackers acquired some of the tools months before the Shadow Brokers first appeared on the internet. Now, the NSA has used sophisticated malware to destroy Iran's nuclear centrifuges and then saw the same code proliferated around the world doing damage to random targets, including American business giants like Chevron. Now, details of the secret American cybersecurity programs were also disclosed to journalists by Edward Snowden, a former NSA and contractor now living in exile in Moscow. Now, a collection of the CIA cyber weapons allegedly leaked by an insider was posted on WikiLeaks as well. Now, Symantec researchers are not certain exactly how the Chinese attained the American-developed code, but they know that the Chinese intelligence contractors used the repurposed American tools to carry out cyber intrusions in at least 5 countries of territories, including Belgium, Luxembourg, Vietnam, and Philippines, and Hong Kong. Now, the targets included scientific research organizations, educational institutions, and the computer networks of at least one American government ally. Now, what it seems like is that governments need to start considering the ramifications of using cyber warfare and how it would be turned around and used on them as well. The wild, wild west of the internet and cyber warfare is coming. Let's hope they realize the unintended consequences before it's too late.
Well, those unintended consequences are going to be part of a trend because nation states are catching up with criminals in the all-important race to steal your data. According to the annual Data Breach Investigations Report, or DBIR, which was released by Verizon this week, the share of breaches attributed to nation state attacks doubled in 2018 from 2017. Organized criminal hacks were still more common. Now, of the external breaches that make up 7 out of 10 data incidents, nation-state groups accounted for 23%, up from 12% in 2017. Now, some experts say that the percentage of nation-state attacks is actually almost certainly higher, since security professionals are leery of attributing attacks to nation-state actors unless they have a significant body of supporting evidence. While nation-state attacks climbed as a share of breaches, organized crime fell to 39% from 50% in 2017. Now, the public sector saw the most attention from nation-state actors, with 79% of all their breaches involving external actors coming from state-affiliated attackers, the DBIR stated. Perhaps coincidentally, the greatest surge in the share of breaches caused by nation-state attacks has coincided with U.S. election years peaking in 2012 and 2016. Most state-sponsored and espionage attacks begin with a phishing email, the experts say. In the information industry, for example, 84% of such attacks have a genesis in social engineering. However, employees click on such email far more often than they report the fraudulent messages, according to Verizon. Sounds like someone needs to refresh their training course.
Well, it seems no more prorated final bills for Charter Spectrum, and they're making it more expensive for you to cancel your subscription. So what they're doing basically is, no matter what part of the month that you cancel your subscription, they're going to charge you for a full month no matter what. Charter broke the news to customers in the fine print of their latest billing statements. Stop the Cap reported the change a couple days ago, and they were able to confirm it on a May billing statement received by our Technica staffer in Texas who subscribes to a triple play package with the Spectrum TV, phone, and internet service. Quote, effective on or after June 23rd, 2019, and consistent with the terms and conditions of service, Spectrum will no longer provide a pro rata credit for services sold on a monthly basis that are canceled prior to the end of the current billing month, the notice to customer says. Under these terms, a customer is better off canceling right at the end of a billing period, but customers will inevitably pay for days of service that they don't use if they move out of their homes early or midway through a billing period. Depending on when a new occupant moves in and starts up service, there may be cases where Charter collects from two customers at the same home for nearly a month. This is following how AT&T and DirecTV implemented a similar policy this last January. More of the stories cancel right at the end of the billing period.
Now, last week we talked in length with Oracle about HPC and the demand for it today. So it's only fitting that we see AMD and Cray announcing that they're building the next generation supercomputer together, dubbed Frontier. Now, the Department of Energy at Oak Ridge National Laboratory needs some serious horsepower to crunch some data. And what better way to do that than a system that can perform 1.5 exaflops, or 1.5 times 10 to the 18 floating point operations per second. Now, how fast is that really? Well, think about this. Let's put that in a comparison. A single NVIDIA RTX 2080 GPU manages about 14 teraflops of compute performance with 32-bit numbers. Now, Frontier will actually achieve 100,000 times more than that. Now, the fastest supercomputer in the top 500 list weighs in at 200 petaflops, or 0.2 exaflops. That would mean that they would actually need 160 machines from that list of the fastest supercomputers to actually match Frontier's performance. Now, Frontier will be a customer, use custom versions of AMD's EPYC processors, likely Zen 3 or Zen 4, matched with four GPUs, all connected using AMD's Infinity Fabric. Between nodes, Cray's Slingshot interconnect will be used, which has transfer rates of up to 200 gigabytes per second per port. And the GPUs will have their own stacked HBM, or high bandwidth memory. It will be housed in 100 cabinets, taking about 7,300 square feet of floor space. And the power consumption will be 30 to 40 milliwatts. Now, sounds impressive, especially to hardware geeks out there, but let's talk about the cost. First, it will cost $500 million for the hardware and $100 million for research and development. Now, if AI needed a boost in computational power, this might be it, and the way to burst through those barriers and unlock its true potential. With a measly price of $600 million, let's hope Elon Musk doesn't hear about that price tag.
Well, in business news here in the industry, there's been a shakeup at the top of Symantec. Symantec this week announced an executive shakeup that included the departure of CEO Greg Clark and the naming of a new chief financial officer. Clark became CEO of Symantec in 2016 after the firm acquired web and cloud security vendor Blue Coat Networks, where he was the CEO. Under Clark's tenure, Symantec acquired identity protection vendor LifeLock in late 2016, and in 2017 formed a cybersecurity venture capital arm, Symantec Ventures, which is an incubator for new startups. Richard S. Hill, a Symantec director and former chairman and CEO of Novellus Systems, will serve as interim president and CEO while the company searches for a new permanent chief. Meanwhile, Vincent Pilette, CFO of Logitech, was named executive VP and CFO of Symantec. These executive changes came as Symantec reportedly missed earnings for its fiscal fourth quarter. It announced earnings of $34 million on $1.19 billion in sales, a sales number that was a drop from $1.21 billion 1 year ago.
Now, Windows 10 has had that, you know, capability of running Bash, a Bash shell and so forth. But now, and there, so what's happening is they're now using a real honest-to-God Linux kernel. So let's read the story from Ars Technica. The current Windows subsystem for Linux uses a Microsoft-authored kernel component that provided the same kernel API as the Linux kernel, but written from scratch by Microsoft. Essentially, it translated from Linux APIs to Windows NT kernel APIs, and, well, it worked pretty well. But the current subsystem had a few shortcomings. There's no ability to use Linux drivers, in particular file system drivers. Its file system performance layered on top of Windows' own NTFS was often 20 times slower than a real Linux kernel. It was also a relatively old version of the kernel, and it offered approximately the set of APIs that the old Linux 4.4 kernel did. And that was way back in 2016. Some APIs aren't implemented at all, and others are only partially implemented to meet the needs of specific applications. Well, all is changing with the Windows subsystem for Linux version 2. Instead of emulating the Linux kernel APIs on the NT kernel, Windows subsystem for Linux, also called WSL2, is going to run a full Linux kernel in a lightweight virtual machine. This kernel will be trimmed down and tailored to this particular use case with stripped down hardware support, since it will defer to the host Windows OS for that, and faster booting. The Linux kernel is GPL'd open source. The GPL license requires that any modifications made to the code must be published and made available under the GPL license. Microsoft will duly comply with this, publishing the patches and modifications it makes to the kernel. WSL2 will also use a similar split as the current WSL does. The kernel component will be shipped with Windows, while personalities, as provided by the various Linux distributions, can be installed from the Microsoft Store. By using the Linux kernel itself, Microsoft gets all of the Linux features for free. This is why WSL2 will support Docker containers. All the underlying infrastructure, such as cgroups, is already in the Linux kernel, and Microsoft won't need to implement the features itself. The embedded kernel will be serviced and updated by Windows Update. All in all, a terrific development, and makes me even less inclined to futz around the kludge that is Cygwin.
Now, Firefox continues to come in second for browser market share at around 9.6%. It's kind of a far cry from Chrome's 65.81%. And with Edge at 4.49% moving to Chromium later, Firefox will continue to actually have to do battle and fight their way to get those many as many points as possible. Now, what would you do if you were in the browser fight of your life against those giants? Well, target privacy and security, of course. Mozilla is doing just that, and it's looking for a more efficient way of integrating Tor into Firefox, and the organization is willing to throw money at that problem. Now, at a better Tor integration is one of the key points that Mozilla is willing to fund via its Research Grants 2019 H1 program that the organization announced last month. Now, if you used the Tor browser before, you know that Firefox is at the center of it, but it also is not the fastest browsing experience in the world. Now, the goal of the grant is actually to help with the Tor protocol and find ways to ensure it can actually efficiently scale and have better performance. Now, on that, this is why Mozilla is willing to provide research grants that will help discover a better way to integrate Tor into Firefox without the current performance losses. Now, in order to steal away some of those browser share points, the work done as part of the grant will eventually make it its way into the new Firefox browsing mode named Super Private Browsing, or SPB, that the browser maker is currently working on. Now, the fact that Mozilla is looking to finally embed Tor into Firefox in one capacity or another isn't a surprise. Since 2016, Firefox engineers have been porting privacy features first tested in the Tor browser back into Firefox via an engineering project called the Tor Uplift Program. If you're not a Firefox user, or you're not a Firefox user yet, either personally or at the organization level, it just might become your favorite browser soon. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we do, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in enterprise tech, and that's Grammarly. Now, there are usually those tools that you like or really helps you so much that you keep coming back to it over and over again. And for me, that's Grammarly. Now, not only does it help me really write better content, It helps getting emails right for me too. Now, Grammarly will help correct your writing skills from assisting in grammar, phrases, and sentences. It will literally evolve your writing to mistake-free, clear, and effective writing. Not only will the free version of Grammarly make you write better with the advanced review of critical spelling and grammar errors, but Grammarly Premium adds to those amazing features. In addition to spelling and grammar, they have advanced punctuation, structure, style within context, vocabulary suggestions, conciseness, readability for different occasions, and more. Now, have you ever written those emails, especially to an executive, and then go back and reread it after you sent it and notice, oh man, some of those sentences are almost incoherent with the way I worded them? Well, I can tell you I've done that many times, and being a father of four and being sleep deprived, it happens a lot. Well, Grammarly will literally fix those problems for you and give you the ability to trust what you send now and forever. Now get this, 76% of surveyed premium users now find writing more enjoyable because of Grammarly. Now for me, it really is more enjoyable. I can trust what I'm writing when I write it and when I send it. Now, I can tell you tools are always way better when they integrate with the things that I already use or the apps that I already use today. Well, Grammarly integrates really seamlessly with Microsoft Word and Outlook, and they have extensions for all the major browsers, Chrome, Edge, Safari, Firefox, and they also have a desktop app. So if you are writing in an app that doesn't provide support, like maybe TextPad or Notepad, well, all you need to do is use their desktop app and it will help you write better in those apps as well. Now, do you travel a lot? Well, maybe you do a lot of work on public transport, transit, or on your phone. Well, Grammarly has you covered there as well. And it works with iOS and Android. And for me, they actually have an iOS Grammarly keyboard, and it is a lifesaver. Autocomplete can fail you over and over. And look at, look at all the funny posts you can find on the internet about all the autocomplete fails. Well, Grammarly keyboard can keep you safe here. Not only will you write better, but it saves you from the autocomplete woes. If you haven't tried Grammarly yet, get it right now. It will literally make your writing life better, easier, and more efficient. Go to Grammarly.com/enterprise to get 20% off your Grammarly premium account today. That's Grammarly.com/enterprise for 20% off your Grammarly premium account. And we thank Grammarly for their support in this week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump into the bites. And this week, actually, if you remember last episode, I had a short discussion about SpaceX and how they convinced the FTC to allow them to actually have low orbit satellites even lower in orbit to get better connectivity. Well, during that discussion, we talked a little bit about the future of the new constellation of satellites being sent out by SpaceX and how many years later before we actually saw those fruits of their labor. The interesting thing apart here is that next week, SpaceX will start launching dozens of demonstration broadband satellites all the way up and to actually help their Starlink service. Launching on May 15th, the Starlink satellites will be aboard a Falcon 9 rocket and begin producing service. Now, the question is now, when will we start seeing that service? When will we be able to use it? Well, SpaceX hasn't revealed yet a specific commercially available date, but latest details appear that put SpaceX on track to launch commercial service no later than 2020. That's right, 2020, coming soon. Now, SpaceX told congregational committees that it would launch at least 800 satellites before starting to offer its commercial service. The tech behind Starlink will allow it to offer gigabit per second speeds and latency around 25 milliseconds globally. I'm having a lot of problems with units today. Curtis, I want to throw this to you first. Now, we've talked a little bit about Google Fiber providing internet to small communities and areas that don't have good internet. Once this service takes flight, pun intended, it will be faster than a lot of those services out there. Is this a sign of a possible success because they're already launching and they're ready to go?
Well, anytime you have a satellite-based system and you're actually able to put birds up in orbit, you're way ahead of what most companies do. Because if you look back through history, there have been many, many systems that were discussed and never really got past that. So they're ahead. And I really do think that they have a good chance at providing a real service. I mean, right now, if you are away from a significant population center, your options for broadband go way down. And if you get very far outside those population centers, you're essentially down to one, and that's Hughes Satellite. Now, Hughes Satellite is a great lifeline for thousands or millions of people who need it, but I don't know of any of those folks who say that it's a wonderful service compared to the kind of broadband that we get from terrestrial providers. It tends to be slow. It has a pretty serious lag because of the distances involved, and it tends to be pretty seriously bandwidth throttled, especially after you actually use it. So having a competitor like this could be really amazing. And I would compare it to the kind of benefit we have seen from the various sat phone services. You know, it hasn't been all that long ago where if you needed a sat phone, it was a big deal. You were talking about a suitcase that you connected to a dish that you then set up and did lots of calculations to let the thing work. Now we're down to the point where you can do some satellite text communications for an amount that many people find almost trivial. So I'm really encouraged by this. I love the fact that they're not the only people looking at it. And I really look forward to the day when if you go without internet connectivity anywhere on Earth, it will be by choice rather than necessity.
So Patterson in the chat room brings up a good point. He talks a little bit about Iridium. And Iridium really is no stranger to bankruptcy because the company launched their satellite phone in back in the 90s. And it was almost like a brick-like device that cost about $3,000 with the call rates of $3 a minute. So really barely – not a lot of people subscribed here because it costs too much. Chiba, you remember this. Is this – now they're still around, right? I mean, is this the end of them if this comes along? Mm-hmm.
No, actually, Iridium got bailed out literally by the federal government. They made a huge commitment and kept it afloat. And it is basically the only option, only reasonable option for a lot of scientists to go out in the field, especially if you're out at sea or if you're up in the Arctic or Antarctic or deep in the Amazon. Once this comes out, I'm hoping to get my hands on one, at the very least to play with. And this is actually could potentially be my third satellite phone. My first was that suitcase. It was an Inmarsat phone. It was more than a little challenging to get a connection to the satellites. It was breathtakingly expensive to have a conversation on it. It had a huge, huge set of latencies and a lot of jitter. You had to really and truly get creative on how you spoke to people on the other end so that you could actually be understood. Then I got a chance to use Iridium, which was a huge success for me. It was great. I no longer had to be as concerned about aiming and things like that and time of day. And then I discovered the Iridium short message system, which is terrific because for $65 a month, I can have an unlimited number of inbound and outbound 160 character messages, so SMS. This is going to be yet another quantum leap. We're talking about a system that's low enough that in theory it'll work indoors, which Iridium and Inmarsat both do not. We're probably also going to start seeing multiple tiers on, you know, how much bandwidth you're allowed, how fast you get a channel and things like that. And it's also going to probably have a less expensive – we're probably going to start seeing global pagers or something similar appearing yet again. So this is going to be a really big game changer from the scientific point of view. It's going to be massive. It's going to make ecological sensors. It's going to be a renaissance for us. Could it kill Iridium? Yeah, it might. But it's going to open up some huge, huge new business opportunities, and I, for one, cannot wait to play with it.
So going on that, opening up new opportunities, because you talk a lot about cloud services and that they haven't really opened, you know, data centers in different parts of the world. In fact, we just heard about Microsoft opening one in Africa, being one of the first being there. But, you know, with this type of service, now we're adding connectivity to places in the world that don't have connectivity. Silly question, but is the internet ready for this? Is it the amount of time, amount of users that will now be able to jump on, especially if it's an affordable thing, to the internet, the increased amount of traffic? Are organizations and cloud service providers ready for this? What do you think, Cheaper?
I'm pretty sure. See, the way satellite systems work is this is actually going to be kind of a mesh. It's going to be able to go sideways in orbit so it can pass it. So say, for instance, if the satellite you're connected to is over, say, the Central Sahara, it won't go up and then back down. It'll go up and sideways around the orbital path so it can hit one of the terrestrial stations. And terrestrial stations are probably going to have direct cross connects to any one of the huge continental or regional exchanges. Now, keep in mind, a lot of these exchanges, like the one that I was in Sunnyvale, have so much bandwidth crossing through that data center that it's actually indicated with an infinity symbol. So the price on this is not going to be cheap. This is not going to be, you know, the $59.95 a month, whatever's. This is going to be a fairly expensive service to start. So we're not going to see a huge number of people rushing out to get sat phones. What this is going to do, though, is provide sailors, hikers, and a lot of other people that are occasional users many more opportunities for calling for help and calling, you know, to tell people what's going on. And you know what? I think it's going to be cool. And yeah, I think right at this moment, as long as the people that are designing it are paying close attention to where those exchanges are, there'll be more than enough bandwidth to pull this off.
Fantastic. Well, that one puts that one to bed. Thanks, Cheebert. I do want to send it to Curtis because, Curtis, we're talking a little about doubling cybercrime losses since last year. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, we've been doing cybersecurity for quite a while now, and you'd think that we would be getting ahead of it, but you would be wrong. Because according to the FBI, cybercrime losses in 2018 were double the 2017 toll. Now, the world has, as we know, and we're just talking about, embraced digital technology, but cybercrime is putting a serious dent in corporate finances. Last year, according to the FBI's 2018 Internet Crime Report, reported damages from cybercrime nearly doubled to $2.7 billion. Roughly half of that amount stemmed from business email schemes that zeroed in on wire transfer payments. Now, the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, or IC3, said that the agency received approximately 352,000 complaints about online skullduggery in 2018, which averages out to somewhere over 900 each day. In recent years, the center has averaged somewhat fewer complaints. However, between 2014 and 2018, the reported losses more than tripled, leaping from $800.5 million in 2014 to almost $1.5 billion in 2017 before reaching $2.7 billion last year. And these losses are really well distributed. Practically all businesses, regardless of their size or which industry they're in, are vulnerable to being victimized by cyber criminals. This makes cyber attacks the biggest single risk for today's corporate leader, as highlighted by no less an authority than the World Economic Forum. Now, when you look at what kind of businesses we're talking about, business email scams, business email compromises, as they're known in the trade, are especially lucrative. Now, $1.2 billion of the reported loss in 2018 was pegged on these business email compromises that hijack or mimic actual email accounts using social engineering or hacking to transact unauthorized fund transfers, often via wire transfer. Now, over time, this very successful scam has evolved and now includes both personal, vendor, attorney, and real estate-related emails. Now, hunting down and recovering these unauthorized payments is an area where the FBI has made some headway. In February, the report notes, the FBI established a recovery asset team to focus on repatriating monies lost via these BECs, or business email compromises. Last year, the FBI recouped $257 million unwittingly wired by cyber crime victims, and that is a very respectable recovery rate. Cybercrime is a giant multinational business, continues to proliferate around the globe. Many cybercrimes that have made the news in the past year were responsible for a fairly inconsequential portion of the reported losses for the total. Many of the losses, especially many big ones, don't really get all that much attention, and that's because of both financial concerns on the part of the victims and the ever-present risk of, well, embarrassment. One of the things that didn't cause a lot of trouble, though, is ransomware. Ransomware scams resulted in a relatively small $3.6 million in losses in 2018, according to the FBI, much smaller than their presence in the news would have you believe. Now, the upshot of all this is clear. As businesses everywhere continue to turn to digital technology and transact business online, more and more crime is shifting into the digital realm, and the number of attacks and size of financial losses looks to grow. So let me ask a question of my co-host, and Lou, I want to start with you. What do you think it's going to take to finally see some industry-wide progress against cybercrime?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think obviously starting to implement standards is a big one. Standards in way things are implemented, data is stored, data is secured, that kind of thing will hopefully start the industry moving forward. Obviously, because if they don't meet those standards, they start to get fined and they start to actually have monetary repercussions because of it. So I think that will definitely help this move forward. Will it complete it? No, absolutely not. Also, holding organizations more accountable is another one. We hear a lot of these data breaches. I think it was Yahoo just started getting sued civilly, and people are starting to win those suits about the data breach that was years ago. And by holding these organizations accountable and making them pay out for that accountability scares other organizations. It's almost like a snowball effect of organizations saying, wow, you know, if I don't do this and I don't maintain some standard of security and privacy of people's data, I'm going to start being held accountable for that. But it could actually ruin us. So we're going to start doing that. And of course, things like GDPR and other things like in the EU will also start forcing organizations to do the right thing with data, as well as securing things. So I think definitely standards is the first step. Where it will go from there, I don't know. I have no idea.
Well, Lou, I think you have a great answer in terms of what the industry has to do. Brian, I want to turn to you and ask the question, a number of the things, especially the standards that Lou was talking about, those are really industry-wide. If a single company comes up with a standard, well, it's not really a standard for any true purpose. So while we wait for the industry to come up with these increased standards, what should a company be doing that needs to make a start toward making themselves less of a target for these cyber criminals?
I think a lot of it's going to be education. You know, we need to get people to stop clicking on those stupid emails. The the Nubian prince is not going to share his wealth with you. I'm sorry. but I do want to kind of offer a little bit of perspective. We need to obviously clean house. I agree, standards are necessary. But we need to actually start thinking it's a new reality. So let's put it in perspective. When bank robbery first started rearing its head, when we first started having banks, you know, talk about the James Gang and so forth, everybody started putting more and more penalties. They started building better vaults. They started doing different things. But has bank robbery disappeared? No, it hasn't. So sadly, I think cybercrime is probably the new way of life. And we don't have many people doing bank, you know, physically robbing banks anymore because there's more money to be had in cybercrime. So sadly, it's the criminals are going to go for where the money is. And all we can do is try and remove as much of the low-hanging fruit as possible. If we clean up our house, we start securing our systems, we start educating our employees to quit clicking on those stupid links in those phishing emails, then we might actually have a chance at least making it so that if someone's going to do some cybercrime against me, they're going to have to at least have some serious talent. Just like nowadays, if you're going to have a bank robber going after a, you know, one of these fancy schmancy bank vaults, it's at least not going to be Joe Schmo around the corner that, you know, got his start, you know, holding up the corner store. It's going to at least be a professional that is more than likely spent a lot of time learning his trade. So if I'm going to get robbed, let's at least get robbed by someone that's taking his trade seriously.
You know, I like that. And the model seems to be using the same kind of defense that we see in schools of fish or herds of gazelles on the African plains. You know that the predators are out there. You just want to make it easier for them to, well, eat your neighbor than to eat you. This is going to be something we're going to be talking about for a long time to come. If there's anything we can thank the criminals for, it's providing folks like us something to bring you on a fairly regular basis. And speaking of bringing you things, I'm now going to turn things back over to Lou because it's getting time to bring us our guest, and I suspect at least one more of the sponsors who helps make Twyatt possible.
Thanks, Curtis. Absolutely. After this sponsor, we actually have a really great guest to drop some knowledge on the Twyatt Riot. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor, and that is Atlassian. Now, whether you are an engineer, an IT team, or just one who wants to manage a large team's work items, you probably have used an Atlassian product or two. Now, I remember back in 2002 when Atlassian launched a perfectly timed product that met the needs of that emerging agile market. Originally, it was conceived as a bug tracking tool, but the Jira ticket quickly became that digital record of choice for tracking units of work in that highly collaborative and agile environment. Now, fast forward that 16 years, and DevOps is on everyone's docket, and Atlassian is still leading the pack in areas that helps teams rise to that occasion. Now, for me, I've used Bitbucket for many years for those managing those projects and source code and documentation. Plus, tickets for those projects come through Jira, and I'm alerted through my Microsoft Teams channel of those issues. Now, Atlassian really is the collaboration software company that empowers IT teams around the world. Now, like all organizations, you want to ship products faster, more efficiently, and with higher quality. Now, in order to stay competitive in that cloud-based landscape, IT teams are required to plan and execute faster than ever. Now, because of today's applications are more complex than ever, incidents often require open, agile, smart coordination between ops and software development teams. Plus, you want to ensure your customers' feedback is also included. Well, that's where Atlassian steps in and fixes it all. Sometimes businesses fall short with their disjointed workflows. That's where Atlassian's wheelhouse is. They give you and your organization the power to manage complex collaborations. They provide the technology backbone to help modern IT organizations plan, service, and support that kind of change to propel your business forward. Plus, their tools and services are not just for developers. Atlassian offers an affordable, reliable suite of tools for teams of all size, for DevOps to Agile, IT apps to Ops to ITSM, and whatever's next. They can literally scale with your business. With Jira Software, Confluence, and Bitbucket, Atlassian forms the foundations of effective cross-team project planning, organizations, and communication. With Jira Ops, Opschini, and StatusPage, they help any team to better detect incidents, alert response teams, and coordinate response efforts to resolve issues faster and keep customers and stakeholders up to date and in the loop. Now, your teams can choose tools that are right for your current framework while trusting as you grow, they will grow with you. Like all Atlassian products, the tools for your IT team are easy and free to try. Just head to Atlassian.com/IT to find out what Atlassian's offering is right for your team. Try Atlassian today to see what IT can be. That's Atlassian.com/IT. We thank Atlassian for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twire. And today we have Greg Young, VP of Cybersecurity at Trend Micro. Welcome, Greg.
Hey, welcome all. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Now, Greg, our audience loves to hear about origin stories and kind of people's journey through tech. Can you maybe bring us through your journey and how you ended up at cybersecurity at Trend Micro?
Yeah, 31 years now in cybersecurity. Been very, military, government, consulting, product companies. Was 14 years at Gartner as a lead analyst for network security coverage. And 2 years ago, I joined Trend Micro. And that's where I'm here to speak to you about today.
Fantastic, fantastic. So we know that some of the obvious things that are going on with cybersecurity, but let's start with just kind of the main obvious one. It's cloud adoption, people moving to cloud native. It's the movement from on-premise to the cloud. It's opening some doors to cybersecurity issues and cyber warfare today. Can you maybe bring us through what trends we're seeing as more and more organizations move to the cloud?
Yeah, I think there's a few of them that are a little non-intuitive. So one of them is definitely, cloud itself, not good or bad in security. It's really what you do with it. And the problems we see mostly are during the transition period. So as folks are doing like a lift and shift over to the cloud, that's when a lot of the issues are happening, especially lack of preparedness or using live data in a lot of the sort of initial projects. I think the second one, too, is assuming that there's going to be a lot of the protective measures or protective mechanisms available that you had on premise or in your other kinds of instances that may not be there. For example, controlling the network. So today it's really hard, for example, to get network IPS in your cloud deployments. So you either plan to hunt it down or you go without it. So.
Right, makes sense. Now, I think we're seeing a lot of people, obviously organizations, like you said, lift and shift, they're moving themselves, they're slowly moving themselves. So it's kind of the data, it's the services, it's the applications. How are organizations getting ready for that? I mean, what are IT pros and operation teams, what should they be doing, I guess, would be the better question, as they kind of start to move slowly, sometimes fast to the web?
I think the biggest step is kind of plan for not what you're doing today, but what's coming up. Sounds kind of simple, but one of the most troublesome ones is multi-cloud. And I think, you know, being multi-cloud today is the reality that you're going to have more than just one provider or one cloud, cloud service provider. So start to plan your security around that. And sometimes that can be a hard decision because your dev teams who take the first toe into the water are often going to pick the tools and the techniques used from that a single cloud provider. But that may not help you if you go from AWS to Azure. So planning ahead and assuming that you're going to have multiple providers, I think, is the first one.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think one of the interesting things that I was always worried about, especially as different organizations, is like IT pros and operational teams, they're not familiar with this model. They're slowly learning. What is the best way for these types of organizations and teams within the organizations to kind of stay on top of the knowledge and the best practices of securing endpoints and moving data to the cloud?
Yeah, I think it's hands-on is the best one. That, you know, sort of theory and working groups and planning is one thing, but there's nothing better than hands-on, especially for understanding what the security is and just how these things operate and what the interfaces are and what you can see back for reporting and the like. And also, I think taking on what you're good at and outsourcing the stuff you're not. So, for example, there's really good choices out there today for some of the configuration control. So if you're really stressed, you're not an expert in this area, whatever it be, in sort of cloud security, there's lots of help out there, including some who will take care of a lot of those things that are not issues with on-premise, like, capping the billing. So those kinds of new kinds of configurations are some of the gotchas that orgs need to start to look at and plan for.
That makes sense. So that kind of segues into my next question. There's a lot of security as services kind of open the door today where they're saying, hey, we will help you. We will assist you by doing the monitoring and machine learning about your network for you. Is this helping organizations? Is it hurting organizations? What do you think?
If cloud, everything, in fact, in security, I'm a huge fan of getting extra help, especially for non-core things. They're much better choices than there used to be today. And real deep expertise, especially with the personnel shortage in security, which is such a real thing that you just can't bring in, a lot of sort of, for example, cloud experts or the like. You just won't find those lying around in the street, looking for work with holding up help wanted signs. So non-core things are great to do that with, and there's much better. There's such a marketplace for that nowadays. But don't go cheapest. Find ones that are suited to you and your budget. But lowest cost compliance, not the best. Find the expertise you need, especially around security. That's something that you don't always want to go super cheap on.
All right, makes sense. Now, what about AI, machine learning? Is this making it easier? For instance, systems determining presence of attackers, making sure that they detect incoming data or incoming traffic that's unusual, these types of things. What kind of trends are you seeing there?
Yeah, well, it's certainly people using those words a lot and kind of, AI washing or machine learning washing, things that really aren't, that they're just scripts or the like. But, machine learning is real and there's super value there. Again, if people are in such short supply, low-value tasks, things we've seen before in security, use machine learning for that. Even down non-machine learning, even just sort of scripted things, automating it, huge advantage for the low stuff. Leave your people for the much more involved tasks, things where you need people to be involved, get them involved at the things where they take organizational knowledge or a really specific skill set. AI being predictive, we're starting to see that now, gets really interesting both from the defense side and the attack side. But if you're not deep into AI, don't jump there. Start with machine learning first and start to dip your toe in so you can assess the reality of the AI solutions you're looking at, whether that's going to get you in trouble or help you.
Makes sense. Now, a lot of these solutions, they don't actually change the landscape. But actually, they might change the landscape. And that meaning, like, for instance, IoT devices or social media attacks or phishing attacks, that types of things. Things that services like this can't help. What should be organizations be doing and what kind of attacks are you seeing?
Yeah, so the attack landscape is actually pivoted backwards in a way that we're seeing more involvement of social engineering or, for example, so, as sort of the broad-based kind of, barrage type volumetric attacks, get less exciting. We're seeing attacks now where you can really target individuals or use social engineering or OSINT to get involved. So the biggest one is what we call business email compromise, and that's where you're going after not just spamming an organization with emails to try to get stuff done, but you're going to really craft deeply, an attack on an empowered individual who can do wire transfers, who can move money, who can make decisions on giving you access. That's where the big money is today. So just in the last few days, a local hospital got hit for apparently, several million dollars through, again, business email compromise, like whaling or, advanced spear phishing, whatever you're going to call it. But that is that's where we've seen a lot of the pivot is really focusing down these attacks on a few individuals. Another one is trying not to get caught. That pivot has changed. So ransomware, is a connecting of the dots closer to the money. So instead of trying to capture, credit card data and sell it, that's a lot of work. Ransomware, that's work too. Instead, let's just use cycles to Bitcoin mine instead. Less chance of getting caught. Security teams are not super experienced at doing consumption analysis or watching for that. So that's where the attacks are pivoting as well to crypto jacking or crypto mining.
Makes sense. I do want to come back to that. Before I do, my co-hosts are chomping at the bit here and behind the scenes are virtually raising their hands looking for ask questions. So I want to throw it over to Curtis first. He has some questions about DevOps.
Yeah, Greg, appreciate hearing, you talk about DevOps and the role of the developer in security. my question, you know, to take it sort of the next step, is to look at what containers are doing to security, both in terms of how they're playing with the way companies need to protect a containerized infrastructure. And we're starting to see people talking about containerized security. So can you talk about either of those? I mean, first of all, are containers something that you're having to address the security needs of? And do you see containers playing a role as part of security in the future?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing it today. You know, we spent a large part of this week actually talking about container security with colleagues. You know, it's real. You know, when I, you know, we speak to, you know, enterprises, often I come up with this, you know, sort of mental picture of the, you know, these Russian stacking dolls that work out. And, you know, we've been good at sort of, you know, machine security and then, you know, security virtualized, you know, within the OS and then, you know, within the applications and containers, you know, are certainly just one sort of layer, you know, abstracted within or one layer even more discrete with that. There's been a lot of rules around containers that should never contain data themselves, but I think that's an assumption. But I really liked what you mentioned about containers themselves being used for security. And definitely, you know, as we look at sort of containers being these things that we can sort of add or subtract so easily to apps, what a great technique for security itself. But definitely, you know, as containers also have a whole vendor landscape around those and a whole, you know, standards landscape, you know, yeah, security has to evolve with those if you're going to use containers. So anything you're going to use in tech, and especially in virtualized data centers, you've got to have a security answer for.
Well, you know, you're talking about virtualizing things, and with containers typically breaking things down into service levels so that you have various services that are in different containers. I want to pivot back a little bit to what you were talking about with the machine learning and AI earlier. We've seen a lot of new processors coming out that claim to make AI a more reasonable possibility for organizations. And we also have AI as a service. Certainly IBM would love it a lot if everybody made Watson part of their infrastructure. You know, do you see it becoming something that security groups are going to be able to do some proof of concept and experiments with using some of this more readily available hardware and services, you know, even in the next, say, 12 to 24 months?
Yeah, I think much like computing went through cycles of, you know, availability of tools on-prem and, you know, in the cloud or as a service, you know, I expect we'll see that both for AI as a utility and then for AI as a security tool. I think having, you know, a deep sort of control, though, is what's going to have to be maintained with any sort of AI efforts. And by that, you know, when I look at sort of, okay, how am I going to attack AI environments? Well, I'm going to try to pollute some of the underlying sort of numbers or some of the assumptions it makes in order to sway the AI's view. So if I can influence it, then I can exploit it. So I think that's going to be the key. So I think testing and having access to the full environment and having it exposed enough that you can find those kinds of issues, I think that's going to be key. So in any as a service, much like you know, any cloud computing today, I want to have as much of that exposed as possible. So for, I keep coming back to you, for example, with, you know, a virtualization not exposing the network stack in AI, I want to make sure that I've got a full view of what the inputs and the outputs are going into it so that I can make sure that it's, you know, I'm looking for the exploitability or vulnerabilities in the AI itself. That's going to be some deep, interesting work because, you know, we've always sort of seen that. We've had, for example, a business logic, which has been in app servers, and that's been exploited. And this is like, you know, app servers on steroids. So it's going to be cool.
Well, folks, when we come back, we want to talk a little bit more about cybersecurity. Also, I want to bring Chibert in because he has some questions about cybersecurity. But before we do, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Smart Deploy. Now, if you've been in the tech industry or IT business, you've most likely heard of that golden image. That golden thing promised you that you could deploy machines rapidly at any pace using snapshots of pre-configured machines, but it turns out it wasn't actually that easy. Now, that's where Smart Deploy jumps in and saves the day. Not only does Smart Deploy offer that one-click user migration or data migration for simple wide migrations, but it also has a zero-touch network deployment, imaging over the internet, and it has application deployment to make your project stress-free. Now, what I found to be true is it doesn't matter whether you have 50 or 50,000 computers at your company, Smart Deploy is going to make it easy for you to deploy. Now, how do you do that? Well, you might ask, well, that's just what that patented device driver injection technology is. Where they combine that with technician-built driver packages they call platform packs, and they can evolve that golden image in order to make you and your organization's life really easy. They have over 1,200 platform packs, including ones for Lenovo, HP, Dell, and all of the major OEMs. Plus, when you need a new model supported, you download the golden image to any business at business class computer and run Smart Deploy. Now, Smart Deploy is one of the most reliable, easy to use solutions that's really been trusted by deploying over 2.2 million endpoints. Now, it's the first and only solution to offer imaging over Wi-Fi, meaning that you can now manage your remote users and satellite offices without being connected to that same network. You can deploy images, apps, and updated drivers to any of your endpoints via the cloud using Dropbox, Google Drive, OneDrive, or OneDrive for Business cloud storage. There's also step-by-step wizards will guide you through the whole process and all those complicated steps like sysprep, and they handle it automatically for you, including to the answer. They actually file the automated tasks like domain joining and computer naming and hands-free and zero-touch deployment. Now, there's no ramping up. There's no training necessary, no existential accessories required. Now, you can migrate hundreds of computers to Windows 10 in under an hour with that out-of-a-box multicast support. Now, their Seattle-based support team is made up of imaging and Windows experts, and they're just an email or phone call away that the experts that can help you along that journey. Companies like Nintendo, UCLA, Nissan turn to Smart Deploy to make that dreaded task of computer imaging a bit less painful. And right now, Smart Deploy is giving our audience 15 free licenses with 1 year of support. That's $720 worth of free IT software at smartdeploy.com/enterprise. If you work at a company with 50 to 50,000 computers, head to smartdeploy.com/enterprise to get 15 free licenses with 1 year of support. And we thank Smart Deploy for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Greg Young, VP of Cybersecurity at Trend Micro. Greg, I want to throw over to Chibert because he has some questions for you as well, and I think he's got some great ones.
Yeah. So I want to ask a little bit. This is harking back to the 2014 keynote by Dan Gere about realpolitik in the industry. The gist is, because I know you haven't made it to Black Hat, is that Dan Gere was saying that in the changing days, especially with the cloud and so forth, that the true edge of the enterprise is actually the home. And I just wanted to, you know, get your spin. Do you feel this is a true statement? Do you feel this is a statement that needs some modifications? What does your crystal ball say?
Definitely for her, home workers, it's a big deal. And we actually covered it in our predictions report this year for that reason. It's remarkable. We put all this work into securing our enterprise, sort of offices and all the things we do in security there, physical access to the cabling and things like that. But, home workers are treated the same. And then, they use split tunneling and things like that. So, yeah, it's a soft point. I think that the home and if home would be customers and employees, I think that's the true edge right out to the endpoint. All the stuff in between is complexity too, but yeah, I like that. I think that's a true statement that right out to the endpoint and devices that people are holding, whether it be home or elsewhere on the road, that's the true edge. Yeah.
So have you seen the so-called low-hanging fruit change? You're starting to talk about a little bit about maybe, you know, people are doing Bitcoin mining and things like that. But what are the kinds of things that, you know, John and Jane Q Public need to go and really take a look at? Because our viewers are both home, you know, residential, you know, home regular people, but they're also enterprise people. What are your suggestions to avoid being the low-hanging fruit and to defend their both home and business machines?
Yeah, I think three steps. One is, you know, be choosy what you buy. Number two is patch your stuff, because that's now your responsibility. And third is, you know, that you're going to have to try to segment yourself and be aware of it. So the more technology you bring to your home that you're connecting to your office, or your customers, that's the more surface area now that you have to protect. So maybe you're going to segment yourself, you know, from all your smart devices at home, you know, from your office equipment. You know, maybe you're going to have a second, a wireless wireless LAN for work versus home use and the like. So those are the steps that I think for home offices or, you know, people, individuals have to take. Corporations are sadly really lacking on the kind of direction they give home workers. Heck, they don't even give them tools. They don't even give people a cable anymore to stop, you know, laptop theft and the like. So, you know, work with your enterprise, number one, work with your company to help you be more successful. But two is, you know, you've got to take more ownership of your own environments now. Especially for a lot of devices, if you have multiple laptops you're using for home and work and you go between them, you know, make sure they're protected too.
Right, makes sense. I do want to get to that. I do want to talk about a little bit about bring your own device. But first, before I do have a question, and this is kind of a little bit of a pivot, but it's more about a lot of these systems today, they don't really talk about, well, hey, the network could be already compromised. You could already have a hacker already kind of being like come almost like a sleeper sitting on one of your nodes, already gained access, but they're just waiting and ready to go. And there's not a lot of systems today that detect the egress of data out of your network, especially if it's out of the ordinary. What can organizations do if they just kind of have that assume breach mentality? What can they do to determine these things and watch for these things?
Yeah, one is you brought up a great point about sort of the egress of data. So a couple of things. One is organizations really have to make a decision about encrypted, you know, encrypted links. As we've reached the tipping point now, we've gone past this 50% point of how much network connections are encrypted, or how many packets are encrypted at the enterprise edge, whatever that edge is going to be. You're going to have to crack into some of that stuff, especially if it's an important link, and inspect it. It's a hard decision. It's a computationally expensive one. But, you know, it's like having an entrance that you don't have any cameras on anymore going in and out of your bank. You've got to take care of it somehow, especially for its important stuff. So that's one. Secondly, there's some really cool technology out there today for watching for unusual stuff. We've come a long way in sort of analyzing things. Even if we can't decrypt it, we can still spot connections and behavior to say, wow, look at that data going through at this time. That's unusual. Time of day, who it's coming from, into the sort of behavioral analysis. We can do some really cool stuff to find that today. So even deploying that technology to know when it's happening, even if you can't stop it in the first place, let's say, that's really valuable. And I think the other one is just minimize sort of the data that you have. Sad case that so many organizations have tons of sensitive stuff. They really don't need to have have available, especially older data. And a lot of the breach notices we all get, I'm sure everybody on this call has gotten, you know, is stuff that really shouldn't have been hanging around for a long time.
Makes sense. Absolutely. So let's go back a little bit to the BYOD, because I know a lot of organizations are having to deal with this. They're, you know, people are bringing multiple devices, whether it's laptops, mobile phones. What type of attacks are you seeing that are new here that are kind of focusing on that? They're knowing that, hey, organizations are not really necessarily ready for this, even though they should have been ready. And even though they're using things like mobile device management and so on, how are attackers getting through still? What's going on?
Yeah, I think the first one is in the, you know, knowing that there's all this technology in the way, going back to the human side. So we know that there's tons of technology being deployed. Let's go back to exploit the individual. You know, let's do it again through, you know, business email compromise, doing a lot of heads up intelligence work to find out who that key individual is and what kinds of emails they do. this is, in fact, one of the uses of AI and machine learning has been in writing style analysis even. So if you can't stop the emails, if you know they're going to be on multiple devices, possibly home ones or other kinds of tablets on, you know, an airplane or something, then, you know, focus on the trying to catch protecting key individuals first and then working backwards. Another issue around a lot of these multiple devices, even just scale of detection. With Internet of Things now adding billions of devices every year, a lot of our systems we've relied on, like SIM or other ones, they're getting stressed now, even just to be able to accommodate the numbers of devices that are being added. So once again, picking and choosing what you're going to use and, you know, where you're going to position it gets even more important as some of these systems get more stressed.
Makes sense. Now, I was actually watching a talk that you had done. You were talking a little bit more about some of the newer technology, more complex technology around mobile phones, which is SIM jacking. Can you maybe go a little bit more into that? What's happening here and why we're seeing this?
Yeah, so across with SIM jacking is, swapping out SIMs where folks aren't expecting it. So against again, if you can get control, you know, great control of a device, you've got that individual. So there's times when a device is physically not under control. And so if you can swap the SIM card in them, what a great simple technique to do. You don't need to exploit a lot of other software and the like. If you get control of that communication point, that's a great attack.
Interesting. That's very interesting. I do want to throw it back to Cheaper because Cheaper does a little bit of question about securing endpoints.
Yeah, so I've been kind of keeping an eye on what our friends in California are doing, and they're talking about actually forcing corporations, manufacturers to actually go through a grading process on their security devices, you know, high, medium, low, enterprise. I'm not sure how they're going to do it. But it's pretty clear there's some real El Cheapo home firewalls out there, and there's some home firewalls that are considered enterprise grade. Do you consider that a good direction, or is software good enough, or is it going to be a combination of both?
I think at the end of the day, it's going to be software that, when you look at what drives sort of things today, most appliances are really based on sort of just accelerating things. So when we look at, for example, most firewalls today, 95% of them are delivered on hardware. Well, why is that? Well, it's because of the acceleration factor, being able to, operate at network speeds and not make things more latent. So it's really a performance play. Cheapest is a problem, especially around IoT. So any sort of standards, really tough to do. I ran a roundtable over in the Middle East. It was an oil-producing country, and everybody there crossed their arms and said, Internet of Things, we're going to fix it with standards. It's going to take care of us, which is aspirational, but it kind of passes the buck, and I don't really see that working, especially when folks are buying either really expensive things that will never have security built into them, because then if they add security, they will not be the cheapest thing anymore, and they will not get the business. And somebody who – their competitor who doesn't have security will win the bid. And the other one is a lot of the devices being used, the companies designing them are coming into technology like it was 40 years ago, not really – experience dealing with the threats of the technology, the tools, but the adversaries they're facing are current. They have this 30, 40 years of collective expertise. Software definitely is going to be the key. And for home use and home devices, it's great to shield things and also to bolt things on. If we know they're not going to be designed secure in the first place, either add software onto it or bolt on something, physical device, or a case of a router, that's a place to catch at least a lot of things, until we hit 5G, and then, all bets are off.
You talked a little bit about standards. You said, hey, some countries in the EU, they're trying to force these things in hopes that it'll kind of standardize things and make things a little easier. We know that a lot of organizations are targets. Doesn't matter what organization you are a target. But are there are we seeing trends of specific targets on the web that are being targeted because there's no standards?
Yeah, I think some verticals do a really good job. For example, you know, the SCADA or power generation, power distribution, the nuclear industry. They're as peers, they've done a really good job of coming up with standards that they collectively have developed and work well for them. I'm a big fan of that because, you know, it works for them. It's not something being imposed from the top down or just from bottom up or from an industry for people to sell more stuff. It's really they bought into it. So I think that's valuable. I think also around cryptography, there's some great standards there. But as an industry, we have a terrible track record of developing security standards. And I'm thinking back to things like Common Criteria or some of the other standards that are out there, or some of the country ones that they try to impose, that when the rest of the stuff is developed elsewhere in the world, it gets really tough. But I really like the ones that are developed for industry-specific or verticals. HIPAA and some of the healthcare ones are a really good example of that. No matter what you think of it, it's healthcare specific. It speaks to their industry, and it's something they can buy into and assess themselves on as doable. So I think those are the ones. To answer your question more specifically, for example, around healthcare patient data, I'm going to try to go after that, where I think that people aren't used to dealing with those standards, or maybe they're not as concerned as a hospital would be. So, for example, some of the device manufacturers would be, or somewhere in the supply chain before it gets to the hospital, that's going to be, where I'm going to do bad things. As a side note, one of the challenges we've seen there is not an attack on for malicious reasons. It's actually for greed, where counterfeit devices are being introduced in the supply chain. So you think you're getting an IV monitor that is of a current vintage, when actually it's 5 years old, and they put a new sticker on it so they can sell it for more money. But it's really hard when you try to patch that.
There's an interesting stat that I'm reading here. It's according to the recent cyber risk index, there's 80% chance a company will face a cyber attack or data breach this year. That's a crazy stat. I know we're seeing more data breaches on the rise. What's the first thing organizations should do? Where should they go? Where should they start learning? How should they secure?
Yeah, it's a great number. It's in one respect, you got to assume it's going to be 100% that, you know, you're if you're really targeted, especially by a motivated or advanced attacker, you know, you're going to get hurt no matter who you are. In that case, I think it's thinking about these things beforehand, and also owning up to it and not trying to bury it. I'm also a big fan of not, victim shaming, that if a large attacker goes after somebody, you know, they're going to find some way to do it. But then what do you do about it? So, for example, being prepared, a case of, just the basics around, a significant backup, for all of the cases of ransomware with a significant deep backup capability, you're relatively immune in most respects. So doing that, and then also understanding what steps you would take. So how are you going to tell interested parties? What steps are you going to take to, recover data to get your systems back up online? And do you even have contacts in law enforcement, for example, that you would contact quickly rather than having to search for them? So, thinking ahead, taking the steps today that you know you're neglecting or you haven't gotten around to, and with the assumption that, it's going to happen eventually. It's just a question of when, sadly.
We've been talking with Greg Young, VP of Cybersecurity at Trend Micro. Greg, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little low on time, but before we close up, I wanted to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where people can go and learn more about cybersecurity, maybe how Trend Micro can help here.
Yeah, Trend, we've got a huge outreach program with myself and a lot of colleagues. So we put a lot of assets online for folks to have. So, trendmicro.com is always there. And as well, we've got a lot of resources for even stuff that markets that we're not in for security. We're really eager to help people, with those as well. That's all there. And some depth as well. I've got some great colleagues as well, like Mark Nunakovin and John Clay and a few others who are really deep into some narrow areas.
Fantastic. Well, Greg, thank you so much for being here. We really do appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for making it painless and fun. So,
absolutely. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 Cybersecurity Risk Index. But I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-hosts in crime. First, I want to start thanking our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi, and our loyal producer as well. Gbert, where can the folks at home find you and all of your great work?
On Twitter, I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or I'm Gbert at
twit.tv. Better yet, why don't you hit Twiat at twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. I'd love to hear you. I'd love to hear your show ideas. And I'm looking forward to seeing if you guys like the Twiat After School specials, which should be coming up very soon. And by the way, guys, I learned something really, really interesting yesterday when my negative 80 Celsius freezer was getting repaired. Did you realize that Freon and Freon-like substances are going away? And the EPA is now forcing people in the refrigeration business to use hydrocarbons. In fact, that negative 80 Celsius freezer used propane. Very small amounts at very, very, very high pressures. But it now has to be that if there's a leak and it vents to the atmosphere, not poke holes in the ozone. How's that for a piece of trivia?
Thanks, Cheebert. Well, folks, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, where can the folks find you and all of your up-and-coming journeys as well?
Well, starting next week, they can once again find me writing at Dark Reading after my week-long vacation. The following week, I will be out in Las Vegas at Interop. I'm going to be tweeting, Instagramming both of those, so please look me up. I'm at KG4GWA on Twitter, Kurt Franklin on Instagram, and would love to see you following me in both of those locations.
Thanks, Curtis. Thanks to you both. I wouldn't want to do this show without you two. Thank you so much. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well, because you are our loyal listeners and our followers. You drop in each and every week to listen and learn about the latest enterprise goods and IT goodness for that week. So we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, plus all the show notes, information about our co-hosts, guest information, and links to the show stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you get those really helpful subscribe and download links for the video of your choice, audio version of your choice, HD video version of your choice, and you can listen on any one of your devices as well. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT goodness news. So go ahead and subscribe, as well as share that subscription with your show, with your friends and family as well. Also, remember, we do this show live each and every week on Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time. That's live.twit.tv. Of course, if you want to jump in and learn, watch live, you should jump into the chat room live as well at irc.twit.tv. We've got some great characters in there. Patterson, Robert Bigelow, Bleep Burp, everyone, Eric Dunkman. They had some great questions during the show. We'd love to hear from you and get some questions from you as well. Also, don't forget, you can follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There you can see all the latest and greatest I do at Microsoft each and every week. Also, check out dev.office.com. There you can find all the stuff that I do at Office and how to go ahead and customize your experience with Office and make it more productive for you and your organization. I also want to thank everyone who makes the show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa, who continue to support us each and every week. And we couldn't do this show without them, so thank you so much for their support. Also, thank you to everyone, all the engineers at Twit. Thank you for your support and all your help. And also thank you to our loyal producer, Mr. Brian Chi. He does all the bookings and the plannings and gets the show going, and we really couldn't do this show without him. Now, before we sign out, I also want to thank our TD for today, Victor. Victor, you know the tradition, sir. What was today's topic?
I'm not going to say the easy one about Cheebert's freezer, but I think it's don't be the low-hanging fruit because better your neighbor than you.
Better your neighbor than you. I don't know if we can run cybersecurity in an organization that way, but maybe. Well, you're very close, very close. I would say cybersecurity is one of the single biggest risks in an organization today, but you were very close. We're very close.
That was on the tip of my tongue.
All right. Well, maybe next time, sir. Maybe next time. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.